My name is John Bosnich. I'm a Canadian Serb, a journalist who covered the war in the former Yugoslavia and spent considerable time in Bosnia, where General Ratko Mladic was the commander of the Bosnian Serb forces in the war. I've called Miodrag Zarkovic. Miodrag.
We've been for the entire day fighting on social medias about Ratko Mladic and his legacy, you know. So, yeah, even if I wasn't working, I would probably be awake and argue with, I don't know, Muslims or Croats or Serbs who hate Serbs, you know. So, yeah.
Give me your synopsis of the role of Ratko Mladic. Do you consider him to be what the Western media is calling the butcher of Bosnia? And what would have been the result for the Serbian citizens of Bosnia if he had not come into Bosnia and taken charge of the Bosnian Serb forces?
Let me quote a brilliant man who you might be familiar with, John, a man who once said, the most emotional thing in the world is called hard facts. You know who said that, right?
I did.
Yeah. And I will try to stick with the facts because I'm a Serb, meaning I'm biased, you know, because that's how the world functions. You know, if you're a Westerner, you are allowed to have opinions and everything, and you're never considered biased. But if you're a journalist who is not non-Westerner, you are always considered biased. In an attempt to avoid that, I will try to stick with only the facts that can be, that are easily verifiable, that everybody can check. I will lean on what Russell just said. It's not only that the Serbs of all the three sides, basically there were three sides in the Bosnian War, Bosnian Muslims, Croats, and Serbs. By the way, all three are natives of Bosnia. Nobody from them came to Bosnia from somewhere else. Ratko Mladic was born in Bosnia. He was a Yugoslav citizen because that was part of Yugoslavia back then, but he was born in Bosnia, actually in the middle, in the very central part of Bosnia. You don't get more Bosnian than his native town of Kalinovic. And he was, so all three sides are native of Bosnia. It was a classical civil war. There was no aggression from Serbia. Actually, if there was aggression, it was from the Croatian side, because the Croatian army, in at least two examples, invaded Bosnian territory at the beginning of the war in the early spring of 92. Of all the three sides, not only that the Serbs were the only one to get the large portion of the blame, but I will now quote Indian General Satish Nambiar. He was, I believe, for more than a year, the commander of the UN peacekeeping forces in Bosnia during the war, during the last stage of the war. And he wrote a public letter, if I recall correctly, somewhere late in 95, so 31 years ago, where he said, "We knew that all three sides were committing atrocities and war crimes. But unlike Croats and Muslims, Serbs were the only one who didn't try to fool us, to trick us, to play dumb with us." So if he said in a letter, if we found a village, Serb village or a Croat village, that was practically massacred by Bosnian forces, and we knew that as a state of fact, you know. But when we would confront Bosnian army with that, they would be, no, we didn't do it. If we were to find a Serb or a Muslim village that was massacred by Croatian forces, and we confronted Croatian forces with that fact, they were like, no, we didn't do it. As opposed to that, if there was a Croatian or a Muslim village that was massacred by Serbs, and we confronted Serbs about that, Serbs were like, maybe we did that. So that's another distinction between the Serbian side and the other two sides. Now, as for the Hague Tribunal, the Hague Tribunal officially brought up charges against Ratko Mladic, who was the head commander-in-chief of the Bosnian Serb army, and Radovan Karadžić, who was the president of Republika Srpska, that's the Serbian entity inside Bosnia and Herzegovina. So the Hague Tribunal brought up official charges against the two of them in 96, I believe. The main witness, maybe even the only witness on that bringing up of the charges, was Dražen Erdemović, an ethnic Croat who was also a mercenary and who fought, somehow managed to fight for all three sides in the civil war. First for, I believe, Bosnian Croats, then for Bosnian Muslims, and then at the end for Bosnian Serbs. When he surrendered to the Hague Tribunal, and he surrendered not because he wanted to come clear with his conscience or whatever, no. He had some trouble with other mercenaries. He was even wounded in a gunfight. They were arguing over money, of course, and you know, he was wounded. And in order to save his life, he surrendered to the Hague Tribunal as a witness. So in order for him to testify on that bringing up of the charges, he was declared unfit for his own trial. But as unfit for his own trial, he was the main witness or even the only witness on the bringing up of charges against Radovan Karadžić and Ratko Mladic. So that is how the trial of Ratko Mladic and later on the trial of Radovan Karadžić actually began. So I think that answers the best your question about
so the star witness
for Mladic to have a fair trial in the Hague.
No, the star witness against Ratko Mladic was disqualified as being mentally incompetent in his own defense trial. But he was completely competent to testify against the president and the general, neither of whom he ever met during the entire war.
Yes. Actually, there's a brilliant book about all that affair, about his testimony in The Hague, Dražen Erdemović's testimony in The Hague, a book written by Germinal Trivico. He is a Dutch-Bulgarian journalist who covered The Hague Tribunal for years and years. And the book is called The Crucial Witness. And it is actually about Erdemović. There you have all the details. Everything I'm saying can be, as I said, easily verified and checked.
Okay, Miodrag, to sum up, there are many Serbs today, especially in Bosnia, who consider Ratko Mladic to have been their savior and to have literally saved their lives. We just heard from Russell Gordon, an American photojournalist who was there and saw and spoke to people after the fact, who said that he believes that there wouldn't have been any Serbs left and that Bosnia would be an Islamic Republic had Ratko Mladic not led the troops, who were outnumbered, to defeat the Muslim forces. Your view?
Well, I completely agree with that. I mean, we, of course, nobody can say what would have been if, you know, what if. But it's a very realistic guess, you know, because actually, a genocide happened only a generation before that.
Genocide of Serbs by Muslims and Croats.
From 1941 to 1945, Bosnia, as well as the rest of Yugoslavia, was occupied by Nazis and their allies. Bosnia was part of the independent state of Croatia, which was a Nazi
basically country. A part of Greater Croatia.
Greater Croatia, So Greater Croatia was ruled by Nazi collaborators, Ustaše movement, Nazi allies. Particularly, they were more Nazis than even Nazis, you know. Even Nazis were terrified with the atrocity. They were horrified with the atrocities of Ustaše against Serbs. So in the wider territory of independent state of Croatia, and specifically on the territory of Bosnia, from 1941 to 1945, there was a genocide committed against Serbs.
And now that genocide, Miodrag, that genocide, did that exceed the 8,000 people that General Mladic is accused of killing among the Muslims?
By at least 100.
What do you mean, 100 people?
At least 100 times. By at least 100 times.
So in World War II, 800,000 Serbs were killed by Muslim and Croat Nazis. Yeah. And in this war, Mladic was accused by the tribunal of having killed a total of 8,000 Muslims.
Mladic killed was Mladic's own father. He never met, actually, his father. He never knew him. His father was killed, I think, even before Ratko was born, or like several months after Ratko was born. And he said in one of the more famous his interviews, like from 30 years ago, that he was the third generation of his family who grew up without a father. You know, so it's like a tradition there. Serbs really lived through multiple generations through some of the most horrific circumstances ever. You know, so that is the way Ratko Mladic was brought up. That was his reality. Now, he grew up in socialist Yugoslavia. He entered the military service. Then he became a professional soldier. In socialist Yugoslavia, professional soldiers had a very comfortable life, but he was one of those people who didn't take it lightly, even though he very well could. Many officers, especially colonels and generals, took the military service very lightly. You know, they enjoyed all the privileges, but they didn't care so much about their duties. Ratko Mladic was, even by his own peers, you know, many of whom actually fought against him later on in Bosnian War, he was always a dedicated soldier, a very professional, very, 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 very committed to his duties, you know. So let's just now focus on the last 35 years of his life. In 91, Ratko Mladic is 48 years old. He is the colonel of the Yugoslav army, and he happens to be stationed in Croatia, when the war in Croatia broke out. Why? Because, as later on testified by by Croatian diplomats and leaders, because they wanted the war. They could separate without the war, no, but they actually wanted the war. So he was there when Yugoslav army, many of the troops under his command, were attacked by Croat separatists. So he didn't have a choice, actually. I mean, he could surrender, I guess, but that was the only alternative to what he did. He accepted the fight. The Yugoslav army was attacked in Croatia and later on in Bosnia, but let's talk about Croatia now. So from 91, he was involved in Yugoslav wars, not because he wanted wars or had actually any viable or realistic option or alternative. He was forced to that. Then,
and he represented the federal government of the country,
the only legitimate and legal military force in the country at that point. You know, Yugoslav army. You may or I may dislike that army because it had communist symbols. You know, many disliked that army at the time because we were like anti-communist. I was as a young guy back then. You know, heavily anti-communist with my sentiments. You know, but even I at that point couldn't deny the fact that that was the only legitimate and legal military force in Yugoslavia at the time. So he was the colonel, high officer of that army. He was attacked, as well as the rest of the army, in Croatia. Then there was a negotiation. The Yugoslav army withdrew from Croatia, and he found himself in Bosnia, again, as the colonel of the Yugoslav army. And then he was once again attacked in Bosnia. Now, same thing has happened in Croatia, happened in Bosnia. Yugoslav army, after some negotiations, decided to withdraw from Bosnia. But he, as a native of Bosnia, as I said, he was born in the very central region of Bosnia, of course was given an option, like every other single officer and professional soldier who was born in Bosnia. He was given an option to remain there. Of course, to defend his own home, his family, his friends, you know. So, yeah, that's what he chose. And that is when he made, I mean, to say that it's a fateful decision is actually an understatement, you know. He made the decision with, if I recall correctly, I mean, I'm telling you now something that I heard from the people that were close to him at that point. There were like 12 of them, officers, Serbs, officers of the Yugoslav army, born and raised in Bosnia, who made a decision to lead Serbian nation in Bosnia, Serbs in Bosnia, to lead them, to protect them, to organize a functioning defense against Croats and especially Muslims, who were the largest, you know, population, ethnic population in Bosnia, who already, both Croats and Muslims, already had organized military force on the ground.
That, you know, and this means that those military forces that they had organized were unconstitutional and illegal, irregular forces in the country of Yugoslavia. My final question to you, Miodrag, is this, because we can't go much longer with the English radio station with which we're speaking. If the Croat and Muslim perpetrators of similar acts or worse acts than those conducted by Ratko Mladic were never charged and never jailed, was it justice to condemn Ratko Mladic to life in prison for responding to their attacks in the same way that they had made those attacks on Serbs?
Out of pure respect for Ratko Mladic and for every single soldier who fought under his command, or even soldiers who fought against him, I'm really not going to talk about hypocrisy. And you can write an encyclopedia about the Western hypocrisy and about the double standards of the Hague Tribunal or whatever, but I'm not even going to talk about that. Because Ratko Mladic, what I wanted to say a moment ago, you know, for 5 years, he was actually engaged in war activities. And then for the next 30 years, he spent next 30 years, final 30 years of his life, for the first 15 years, hiding, actually trying to stay away from the Hague Tribunal. And the last 15 years of his life, he spent in the Hague prison. So he's a guy who spent the last, he literally gave his life. He also risked his family. His daughter, who he adored, died under very suspicious circumstances in the middle of the war. He never met his grandkids by his son, you know, or he actually didn't spend any quality time with them, you know. So he had to hide from the Hague Tribunal and then to spend his last 15 years of life in the Hague prison, and he never complained. He never expressed any regret, any, rethinking.
Remorse.
He never. He was always very conscious about why he made his decisions. He knew what the consequences might be, and he fully accepted them. Out of pure respect for such a man, for all the people that who fought under him, and I actually met quite a few of them. I made a documentary about one of the units that was directly under Ratko Mladic's command. And I saw firsthandly how much his fighters respected him and respect him to this day. So out of pure respect for them and for him and for his struggle, for his fight, for his cause, I'm not going to even talk about double standards. He wore his cross proudly and with integrity that is inspiring, to say the least. I can only hope to do at least that justice. I mean, in this sort of conversation, we can't do justice to his life story and whatnot. But even if I think that many actually, it's hard to say it 100% what I'm about to say. I'm not convinced 100%, but I saw Bosnian Muslims, even people who fought in the war. I met a person who actually respect that commitment of him, of his. He knew very well, even in the war years, he knew very well what he's up against. He never treated any of the British generals or American generals or German generals, or he never treated them as his betters. On the contrary, he treated them as his equals, or even as, if they deserved, he treated them as people who are morally under him. As he famously said, "I didn't come to their country to fight a war. They came to my country. I fought only one war in my life, and I fought it in my own territory, in the country where I was born in."
In my birthplace.
In my birthplace, yeah.
Thank you very much, Miodrag. I think that basically sums it up. I think it's pretty well understood
Can I just intervene a bit here? That was fascinating. Absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much. Is it Miodrag? Is it?
Yes. My name is Miodrag.
Yeah. Well, lovely to meet you, man. Amazing.
Yeah.
And I really, really feel your passion and the justice in this. I mean, I at the time was following this war in Yugoslavia. It's quite clear that Yugoslavia was actually a wonderful actual beacon to the world of this half capitalist, half communist society, which wasn't Soviet, which Tito really pulled together something different, something unique, and that NATO could not bear this example to the world. Many of my friends, older people now, had fantastic holidays in Yugoslavia back in those days. They loved it. You had your own airline, which people used to fly down to that part of the world and have a fantastic time. And what we've seen since is the slow dismantling of those social justice in that part of the world. I'm not a communist, I'm not a Marxist, but I can see you've got to have a balanced economy between the state and private interests, and the state's got to be in charge. You know, anyway, so I'd just like to ask one thing, which is of you, which is about the role of NATO in all of this, because as far as I understand it, really, this was a NATO operation with the various of the separate ethnic groups being given arms to start the breakup of the country after Tito had died.
How many days do I have to answer this question?
you got 5 minutes.
Actually, it's much more complicated. Of course, I mean, you have to simplify it a bit, you know, but I will try to be as precise as I can, you know. There were ethnic tensions, heavy ethnic tensions, dangerous ethnic tensions in the region ever since Croats and others weren't ready to follow us Serbs in creating our own independent policy in Yugoslavia. Basically, Yugoslavia was a failed state from the get-go. I'm sorry to say like that. I know you have fond memories and positive impressions about Yugoslavia. Many foreigners do and did. But I'm not sorry for Yugoslavia. I was born in Yugoslavia and never liked it too much. I'm sorry that it was brought down in such a bloodshed in with so many casualties. We could go our separate ways peacefully. But sadly, many in the region didn't want that to happen that way. And as you said, many in the West didn't want it to happen that way. So yes, it was instigated and helped a lot by Westerners, especially Germany at the beginning. Germany was leading the charge. Germany was leading the initiative to make the bloodbath. Because, you know, all the circumstances like lead one into another. You know, Germany was just unified back then, in the early 90s. So they wanted to show how much more powerful they are once they are unified than before as the two separate states, you know. So they actually used the Yugoslav conflict as a field where they could show their strength, their diplomatic influence and whatnot, you know. So they forced, in a way, many Western, especially European countries, into forced is a too strong a word, you know, but they they led other European countries into recognizing Slovenia and Croatia as independent states, even though that was actually what led to the outbreak of the war. Compare how tough, how long it took for Britain to separate from the European Union, which was a much more loose union than what Federal Yugoslavia was. And Slovenia and Croatia were practically recognized as independent states instantly, at the very minute that they declared their so-called independence, even though there were a number of issues with ethnic Serbs living there, with borders, whatever, that could have been resolved differently or more fairly or more legitimately, if only given time, you know. But when Germany and other Western countries followed by were following, you know, with, they followed the German example, when they recognized Slovenia and Croatia as independent states, at that moment, the war was unavoidable. And Bosnia followed soon after, but Bosnia was even more specific, because I will now quote my American friends who were actually covering the Yugoslav conflict at the time, and who were also familiar with the Middle Eastern conflict and circumstances at the time. Because of the Middle East, America recognized the potential of Bosnia. You know, America was really not too much interested in the conflicts in Slovenia, which was very short, you know, time-wise, and in Croatia. But when the war in Bosnia was about to start, America recognized, oh, look, this is a great opportunity for us to show Muslims throughout the world that we, who like antagonize Muslims and torture and murder Muslims in the Middle East for decades, but we can show it to them that we're not actually their enemies, because look, we're going to give them, we're going to award them with a Muslim state in Europe. And many of my American friends, which sadly I'm trying to remember their names, right? But when I made the documentary, it was a while ago, so I can't recall their names right away. But they actually testified that many of the Muslims in the Middle East were like, okay, we're going to forgive America for their transgressions and crimes against us if they deliver us a Muslim state, Islamic state in Europe. You know, for some reason, they were all obsessed, both Americans and Middle East Muslims, with a Muslim Islamic state in Europe, which was to be Bosnia. So that's the reason why America got very interested in Bosnia, and why they supported Ali Izetbegović and the Muslim side. One more thing before I go, very short. Hakia Meholić was, you mentioned Nasir Orić. Nasir Orić was the warlord of Srebrenica enclave, but his rival warlord inside Srebrenica was Hakia Meholić. He was the leader of the so-called militia of Srebrenica. He was not a Serb friend. He was fighting against Serbs. He was, by all accounts, a very nasty guy. But even he testified publicly on numerous occasions up until all the way up until his death. He died like 3 or 4 years ago. He testified that Ali Izetbegović said to them, Hakia Meholić was in the closest, in the higher circles of the Izetbegović party, Stranka Demokratske Akcije, Party of the Democratic Action. In a party meeting in the late 94, Ali Izetbegović told them, the rest of the leadership of the party, that Bill Clinton, then president of the United States, phoned him. Tell Ali Izetbegović by phone, look, man, stage a massacre of at least 5,000 people. You know, organize it if you need to. So we, as America and NATO, can intervene on your behalf. And that is why Srebrenica happened. Even though you and I will probably agree that the total number of victims in Srebrenica was much less, there were much fewer victims than 5,000, but that's what Clinton actually asked for. Give me a massacre of at least 5,000 so we can intervene. So, it's very verifiable, everything I said. You can check. I recommend to the people, to especially English-speaking crowd, to look for Edward Herman's late Edward Herman, late great Edward Herman. He was a professor of law, I think, from Chicago. He wrote a book about Srebrenica, a brilliant book where he thoroughly examined all the facts and all the data about Srebrenica and the so-called genocide. There is another book by a guy who's, I'm really not a big fan of. His name is John Schindler. He was the head of the NSA desk for Yugoslavia during the 90s. So he was actually the top American agent for Yugoslavia at the time. And he wrote a book, The Unholy Terror, about what was going on in Bosnia and how the Mujahideens actually were used in Bosnia against Serbs and whatnot. He says that, by his accounts, up to 2,000 former soldiers were executed, no more than 2,000 in Srebrenica. They were former soldiers. By the way, that was a tradition, even back, going back to 1940s. That was a tradition when the Second World War ended in these parts of the world. All the defeated armies, even the ones that were allied with Britain and America and Soviet Union, but if they lost the civil war that was going on parallelly simultaneously with the World War II in these parts, they lost the civil war against Tito communists, they were executed like legitimately without any punishment by Tito's forces in 1945. So it's a tradition in this part of the world. When you capture soldiers of the opposing army and you have like a suspicious, legitimate suspicion that they were involved in murders and whatnot, you are expected to like execute them. I'm not saying that it's right. I'm just saying that even those, and there were also incidents in like the farm in Branjevo, which is near Srebrenica. Some like 100 or something prisoners of war, Bosnian prisoners of war, were executed because one of them actually took a rifle from the Serb prison guard. They were held in prison there and they were okay, but one of them wanted to like break away, so he took the gun of the Serb guard and killed him. When the rest of the Serbs saw that, they executed all of them. You know, so I'm not saying it's not a crime. I'm just saying it's very different from genocide and what the Western media narrative wants you to believe. And Christian Mamampur, I mean, Jesus, do I need to say more? Did that woman ever tell a truth in her life? I mean, did she ever? She's the disgrace to the journalists, you know? I mean, did she ever tell a provable, verifiable fact in her entire career?
Okay, well, look, finally, can you just tell us what is the title of your documentary and if it's available in English translation?
Sadly, I don't think there is an English translation, but there are quite a few parts that are spoken in English because I was interviewing English-speaking interviewees. And it's called Sinovi Srpske, the Sons of Srpska, Srpska Reich, Republika Srpska, short of Republika Srpska. And Serbian expression for sons is Sinovi. Sons like child, you know, like male child. So Sinovi Srpske, Sinovi. That's the first word. And the second word is Srpske. Or in translation, the Sons of Srpska.